The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. One summer blockbuster is boldly going where many have gone before. Star Trek Beyond, Paramount's latest entry in the franchise, dominated at the box office on opening weekend, but it is not entirely without competition.
Make no mistake, the Federation will stand united until the last star burns cold and we see this scourge of Klingon aggression shattered like waves upon the firmament. We will not fail.
That's a clip from the trailer for Axanar, a fan-made Star Trek movie. There's a long tradition of tolerance towards Star Trek-related productions made by enthusiasts of the series. Now, however, CBS and Paramount are enforcing new restrictive guidelines against unlicensed use of the brand. Marissa Martinelli is an editorial assistant at Slate who wrote about the crackdown on Star Trek fan productions, and we reached her on Skype. Marissa, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia.
So can you give us a quick primer on these new rules surrounding Star Trek fan productions?
Well, the new rules are stemming from a lawsuit that the owners of Star Trek are currently engaged in. So that's CBS and Paramount. They are currently suing Alec Peters and Axanar Productions for their fan film, Axanar. Which we just heard from. And they released a set of 10 rules, I've been calling them the 10 Commandments, which limit how fans can use their material. These range from fundraising limits for how much they can raise for the production, to length limits, they can no longer be more than 30 minutes total, to even just involvement, who's allowed to be involved with these kind of productions.
Now, rules, or let's say some guidelines, have been around for a while. Why are CBS and Paramount cracking down now? Is it just this film?
This film seemed to be the tipping point. Over the years, Star Trek fan films have gotten more and more elaborate. They've raised a lot of money, and this one in particular raised more than $1 million. So part of the problem seems to be that with the new Star Trek movies coming out and Star Trek Discovery, which is the new TV show from CBS, that these fan films could actually serve as competition to the official canon Star Trek.
What do you think the likelihood of that actually is?
Well, it seems unlikely since they're not appearing in theaters. All of these films are available online. However, since they are raising a great deal of money, and because some Star Trek fans are not too happy with the new reboots, they do sort of divide the fandom in a way.
Have other smaller productions suffered as well?
Yes, actually, these rules turned out to be more restrictive than anyone could have imagined. And because many of these filmmakers have been making Star Trek fan films for years, a lot of them had to cancel sequels or continuing web series that they had in the works. Many of them because they had actors from the official Star Trek involved in their productions, which is now a no-no. Others because they had raised too much money or because they did not fit one of the specific guidelines.
How many Star Trek fan productions are out there?
There are so, so many. There are many, many web series, many films. It's too many to count, and it really is its own community. Of course, Trekkies are known for being very passionate about what they do, and a lot of people have not been satisfied with just what the official companies have been putting out, and so they've been making their own. And this is a great way for fans to express themselves and to get involved, but as we've seen, some of them may have gone a little too far.
What about the quality of these productions? I mean, Axanar sounded and looked pretty interesting. You attached a trailer to your story, but you hear the writing and you think, no, they're not ready for prime time.
Well, some of them are definitely very amateur. Others are in a completely different genre. So, for instance, a German fan made a stop-motion film. It took him 8 years, based on Star Trek Enterprise, which, of course, we don't see a lot of animated Star Trek these days coming from CBS or from Paramount. Others, of Gods and Men, is a personal favorite of mine. It actually was made by Tim Russ, who was a character on Star Trek Voyager for years and years. And he's sort of an example of a professional amateur production where he was involved in the official franchise and then he went out and made his own film. And it has many, many actors from the real franchise. And it really does feel like an official Star Trek film.
So under these new guidelines and restrictions, do those get grandfathered in or is CBS Paramount going after them?
CBS and Paramount are not attacking any productions that have already been completely made. They've tried to keep things amicable with everyone other than Axanar, who, of course, they're suing. I know that they've reached out personally to some filmmakers, but in the case of Gods and Men's sequel, which was planned called Renegades, they actually stripped it of all Star Trek elements. So they're going ahead with the sequel, but they've made little tweaks. So the Federation is now the Confederation. Tuvok is now Kovok, little things like that. So it's kind of an off-brand Star Trek film, but it doesn't have the name.
So how about this Axanar case? Is that going to trial? Where is it?
Well, a few weeks ago, J.J. Abrams, who directed two of the official Star Trek movies, told fans that the case was going away and that Star Trek wanted a good relationship with its fans. However, it continues to drag on, and it looks as though it will actually go to trial sometime next year.
Wow. Well, fan fictions, fan productions have long been a part of the culture surrounding Star Trek. You pointed out, you know, fan magazines, radio plays and dramas. So what do you think this means for fans going forward?
Well, I suspect that some fans will go ahead with their Star Trek productions, and if they don't push too hard, I think CBS and Paramount will probably let it go. But they need to be wary, and for some of them, this is the end of their fan filmmaking career, unfortunately.
Well, Marissa, thanks for filling us in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Marissa Martinelli, she's an editorial assistant at Slate, where she wrote about new rules being enforced against Star Trek fan productions. You'll find a link to read her article with plenty of trailers. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. If you've ever heard the initials MMORPG, you already know a little about gaming. That's the abbreviation for Massively Multiplayer Online Role-Playing Game, a genre that includes commercial hits like Forge of Empires and World of Warcraft. These are vast, open online worlds where players across the globe interact with one another in real time. In August, a new game is coming out with a simulated universe that is so unfathomably large that players, even many thousands playing simultaneously, may never come into contact with one another at all. It is called No Man's Sky, and to hear more about it, I'm joined by Chris Sollentrop. He's co-host of the Shall We Play Game podcast. Hello, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So who made this game and what is it about?
It is made by a very small British studio called Hello Games, that is best known for a game called Joe Danger, which means it's not all that well known at all. But No Man's Sky, which is this hugely ambitious game, it's not entirely clear what it is about, which is why it's so exciting. It is a digital creation, not a recreation, but a creation of a universe-sized universe in which each planet is not really hand-created by the designers. There's elements of that, but it's what we call procedurally generated. The computer is building this space, which is what enables it to be so large. And we know that you control a spaceship, that you go from planet to planet, that if you're the first person to discover a planet, you get to name it as if you were some sort of, you know, Renaissance astronomer or something. And then your goal is to move toward the center of the universe.
Okay, so I was reading that there are 18 quintillion planets. It would take, if you wanted to visit every single planet, you'd have to set aside 585 billion real world years. So you said that they generate this from parts. I mean, how do they make such a huge game?
I mean, it's algorithmically generated. So they have, I don't quite understand the math of it. I'm not a computer programmer, but it is a, you know, they've created an algorithm that can generate these planets on the fly. And in computer programming and game design, that's called procedural generation. And procedural generation means each level is not what they call bespoke. It's not hand-created, designed just for you. You know, they work with art design and level design and creature design, but it's a mix of human and machine design. And that's what makes No Man's Sky also particularly interesting, is it's the most ambitious procedurally generated game ever made, I think.
Well, I am not an experienced gamer, but I did look at a trailer. There were about four or five different scenarios. Puts you in the spaceship's driver's seat, traveling through the universe. But I could not figure out the objective of the game. You know, I was sort of thinking, you must be trying to do something. Is there a real clear purpose to the game?
No, see, you say you're not an expert, but this is precisely the question that video game players and critics and journalists have about No Man's Sky, which is that partly why we're so eager to play it, because we're so uncertain about what it is you're going to do in it. Beyond just exploring this space that they've created, scanning for creatures and fauna and flora and finding new planets, they've said there's a story. They said it involves trying to reach the center of the universe somehow. But that's really all we know. And so the big question is, you've made this thing. It's huge. It was written about in The New Yorker. You've gone on the Colbert Report to talk about it. Everyone's excited about it. But what are we going to do inside it?
It sounds really interesting, though very different than some of these blockbuster franchises. You know, I'm thinking Call of Duty or Uncharted. So do you think it's going to be a success?
Well, it's going to come in a pretty quiet time in the video game business in August, right before all those big blockbusters start rolling out in the fall. The fall is sort of the summer movie season of video games. It's when all the big blockbusters, the big sequels, the shoot 'em ups, the explosions start coming. And it's had a lot. People have been very excited about it for 2 years. So I suspect it'll be a success, but, you know, we'll see. It is definitely true that it is part of a movement of games and a wave of games that we've seen over the past decade made by small teams of, you know, a handful of people, for anywhere from 1 to 20 versus the hundreds of people that work on the kind of games that you were talking about, that have made the medium more exciting, more interesting, more vibrant, more personal, more experimental. And so it's one of the reasons I play games, is because it's you get games that you can play in 5 minutes, and then you get games like No Man's Sky that you literally could never play. You could play every minute of your whole life, and you would still never see it all.
Well, Chris Sollentrop, thank you for telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Sollentrop, he's co-host of the Shall We Play a Game podcast. And you can see a web trailer with real footage from the No Man's Sky game, which is coming out in August. I assure you that even if you're not a gamer, it is just a beautifully imagined and rendered thing to experience. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. In the early days of the space program, hotshot pilots were recruited to become astronauts. And for the first time, proud and nervous American families watched in awe as their husbands, fathers, and brothers rocketed toward the moon in teeny little capsules. Nate DeMeo from the Memory Palace brings us the story of one of those astronauts and how he took his family with him into space.
Charles Duke was 25 that spring when man first went to space. He was 26 when he met Dottie. He was on leave from the Air Force at MIT. He went there to get his degree in aeronautics and found out they also had something called astronautics. And it sounded cool. And so he did that too. Dottie was a secretary at Harvard Business School. They were both from the South. And they fell in love and complained together about the winter and were married in the spring. He got his master's. Got into test pilot school at Edwards Air Force Base in California. Dottie liked the sound of California. Didn't think of the desert when she thought of California, though. Soon her husband was never around, and her days were all heat and dust and dashed dreams. Charlie was 29 when their first son was born, and when he saw this thing in the Sunday LA Times, front page, said NASA was looking for more astronauts for the Apollo program, for the moon. And that sounded cool. Sounded cooler to Dottie, who thought lugging a baby around Houston would be an upgrade over the Mojave Desert. Charlie was 31 when their second son was born. And Charlie was never around. He was training to be an astronaut. He loved all of it. Loved learning. Loved the long hours, the weeks away, studying geology in Oregon and Hawaii and Iceland and Alaska, jungle survival in Panama, learning how to troubleshoot the far ultraviolet spectrograph, how to perform a translunar injection, while his sons were learning to walk, how to make sure their lowercase j's dip beneath the line, like a fish hook, while his wife was learning to do everything, everything at the house, because her husband was never around, because her husband was an astronaut. Charlie Duke was 33 that summer when man first went to the moon. He was in mission control. His South Carolina lilt was the voice of Houston.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
As men he knew, co-workers, buddies, bounded on the moon.
That's one small step for man.
That was how things went for astronauts. You were assigned a mission and a role, and it meant that one man talked into a microphone while another walked on the moon. It meant that some families got the cover of Life magazine, got to meet the president, got that at least, in exchange for being without their father, their husband, for days and weeks at a time. Days and weeks that amounted to years. Dottie was in her early 30s when she started searching for something of her own, some sort of meaning outside of her marriage, in work, in smoking weed, in flirting with other men. She was a travel agent for a while. She liked that. She was good at that. Took trips to London, Africa even. But it was lonely, and there was a home to keep, and kids who needed help getting the chain back on their bike, finding the stuffed animal that got tangled up in the covers. And there was a husband who dreamt of the moon. Charlie Duke was 34 when he knew he was going. He was back up in Apollo 13. That meant he would pilot the landing module on Apollo 16. And that meant the moon. He was 36 when his turn came around. And his sons were old enough to notice that their dad was never around. And had seen enough rockets lift off. Seen enough smoke and fire and fathers and capsules catching the light as they shrank in the distance and disappeared into the black they were told lay just beyond the blue sky. To know to be scared. And so Charlie said he would take them with him. And so they got dressed for a family photograph. Charlie and Dottie sit on a bench in the lawn. He's in a yellow button-down. His pants match his tie. They're both that color that Crayola calls burnt sienna. She is in a seafoam green pantsuit and a blue cravat. It's 1972. And there are the boys. Big smiles. Who knows how many takes it took to get those smiles. The oldest, Charles, like his dad and his grandfather, is 7 years old. A big boy. Hands in his pockets, standing tall in front. The youngest, 5-year-old Thomas, leans on both his parents. One hand's on his dad's thigh, one's on his mom's. Who knows how much longer he'll still reach for them like that at a moment like this. There in the snapshot. Charlie was 36 years, 6 months old, when he spent 71 hours on the moon. He collected rocks. That was the bulk of the mission of Apollo 16. Learning about the moon. And that's basically what there is to learn about the moon. Its composition and origins. That and what it feels like to be there. To leap 4 feet off the ground like it was nothing. To see the Earth, moon-sized. At one point, Charlie asked his partner, John Young, the Neil Armstrong to his Buzz, or Buzz to his Neil, depending, how long he figured their footprints would be there on the surface. With no wind, no weather. Young thought about it. Factored in all the things he knew about the moon, and he knew lots about the moon, and figured 4 billion years. 71 hours out of a life, then 36 years and 6 months long, now 80 and change. After all those hours in the classroom, in the simulator, in the field, in the office, in line at the cafeteria, away from his family. And in one of those hours, 240,000 nautical miles from home. One of the last hours on his business trip to the moon. Charlie took that family photo, wrapped in clear plastic, bent a little bit from the journey, and placed it in the dust near the lip of a crater. He liked the idea that someone would find it someday, probably pretty soon. Maybe he'd even come back for it. Maybe on one of the next missions. Maybe one of the scientists on the moon base they hoped to build in the 80s would find it. Maybe a colonist. Maybe one of his own sons on some vacation someday. He didn't know then that he wasn't going back to the moon. He didn't know then that we don't go to the moon anymore. But he liked the idea that his family was there, where they are still, and will be for something close to forever. A snapshot. Two boys. A man, a woman. A moment in their lives.
That story came to us from Nate DeMeo, host of the podcast The Memory Palace. Today on the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, we get the goods from Judy Blume, the patron saint of awkward adolescence. Her best-known books, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, Deanie, Blubber, and Forever, presented plain language, shame-free stories about the confusing and often humiliating transformation from childhood to adolescence. I sat down with Judy Blume in the green room at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, just before a Writers on a New England Stage live show.
This is Judy Blume with the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Judy, which is harder for you to write? Is it the first sentence or the last?
I do start at the beginning. And so there is a first sentence. It may not wind up being the first sentence of the book. Usually it isn't. Sometimes it is. And the last sentence, sometimes it comes and sometimes it doesn't.
Do you edit as you're going along, or do you tend to write it all out and then go back and edit at the end?
At the very beginning, when I started and we worked on typewriters, I wrote everything once and then twice and then three times and then worked with an editor and again and then a fifth time. Now, I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that I can go 20 drafts. And I edit some as I go, but I'm a rewriter. I'm a reviser. It's not just editing. It's getting down that first draft that's torture for me, getting something so that I have the security of knowing that there's something there. And then it gets better and easier, and it grows.
What for you is the worst distraction that keeps you from your writing?
Oh, I can come up with any number of things. I remember in the old days when I had little children at home, it was, you know, getting them ready for school before I would sit down and write. But in those days, actually, I was very anxious to get to the storytelling. In more recent years, I don't know, you know, anything. I can't do this because I'm doing that. Or I don't want to do it. Right now, I don't want to do it anymore. So I have a bookstore. A fabulous distraction.
So where do you like to write? What's the best environment for you?
Well, I can write anywhere as long as I'm there for a period of time. I'm not a person who can take my work on a plane and work on the plane and work in a hotel room for a day here and a day there. I don't do that. I just totally turn off. If, you know, ideas come while I'm in the middle of writing something, fine. I'll jot them down. But I need to really have a working routine. I like to get up and have my breakfast and go to work and stay there for better or worse until lunchtime and then go back in the afternoon.
So for somebody who's a writer just starting out, are there habits that you would recommend for them? Would it be finding a routine?
You know, it's totally different for everyone. I have friends, young friends, who work in coffee shops, and it's like, how do they do that? I cannot imagine working in public on my computer. I just can't imagine it. I like everyone to be gone. If someone walks into the room, I cover the screen with my hands. I have to be that private about it until I'm ready to share it.
So you never share it with anyone along the way?
Along the way, never. Mm-mm.
That's a lot of pressure on the final draft.
But it's not the final draft. It's the draft that I feel is ready to take to an editor. And then I've gone as far as I can go. help me, you know, with the rest of it. Help me do the next draft.
What do you look for in an editor?
Someone who wants to work with you. You know, I'm lucky now because I've been around a long, long time, and I've had some wonderful editors. But in the beginning, I don't think any writer feels that he or she can look for something in an editor. You know, you're so grateful that somebody's interested in what you're doing and wants to work with you.
How many times were you rejected before you were published?
I didn't have that terribly difficult time. I think it was different then. I didn't have an agent. You submitted your work and it went into the slush pile. And I had 2 years of rejections, but I didn't know what I was doing. And with each rejection, I kept going on. I think that's what it takes. It takes that kind of determination. And don't ask me where I got that from, because I've no idea. I cried over the first rejection, and then I got determined. And each time I said, well, they're right about this one, but wait till they see what I'm doing now.
What do you think is the most common mistake that a new writer makes?
That's a tough question, because it's different for every new writer. But I guess a common mistake is trying to get it perfect. The advice I give to anybody, if anybody should ever ask me for advice, is read it out loud. Because when you read out loud, you hear it and you want to make changes. And you take your pencil and you just do that. I think there are people who, you know, the fear of rejection keeps them from ever submitting. And then there are others who think, my work is so great, you know, it's going to get published just like that. And then it doesn't happen, and disappointment sets in. Anything that turns off the new writer is bad. I don't want new writers to be turned off. I want them to feel that they have support and that they can go on.
What was the best advice you ever got about writing?
I don't know. I don't know that anyone ever gave me the best advice. It was just, I was lucky early on. I met up with a wonderful editor, and he just was able to release something in me. You know, I'm best when I'm spontaneous. Let it out without thinking it to death. And I think that's what happens to some people too. You know, you just have to go into that other place inside your head. I don't know how you get there, but I know when I'm there. Because when I'm there and then I stop for the day and I look it over, I say, how did I do that? I don't even know those things. How did I do it? And I know that I'm in that other place, that place where good stuff happens.
Do you have any other dream job that you've been thinking about other than writer? In your life?
I never thought about being a writer as a dream job when I was growing up. I never even knew it was a possibility. So now I think that running a bookstore is going to keep me happy for a while.
Judy Blume, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Judy Blume there, one of the first American authors to write for tweens and young adults. She's now listed as a living legend writer and artist by the Library of Congress. And by the way, she told us after that show at the Music Hall that it would be her last book tour interview ever. So there, an epic moment.